Chapter 2. The Special Operations Network. The Special Operations Network was initiated to handle policing duties considered either too unusual or too specialized to be tackled by the regular force. There were 32 departments in all, starting at the more mundane Horticultural Enforcement Agency, SO32, and going on to Literary Detectives, SO27, and Transport Authority, SO21. Anything below SO20 was restricted information, although it was common knowledge that the Chronoguard were SO12 and SO1 were the department that polices the spec ops themselves. Quite what the others do is anyone's guess. What is known is that the individual operatives themselves are mostly ex-military or ex-police. Operatives rarely leave the service after the probationary period has ended. There is a saying, a spec ops job isn't for probation, it's for life. Millions de Floss. A Short History of the Special Operations Network, Revised. It was the morning after the transmission of the Adrian Lush show. I had watched for 5 minutes, cringed, then fled upstairs to rearrange our sock drawer. I managed to file all the socks by color, shape, and how much I liked them, before Landon told me it was all over and I could come back downstairs. It was the last public interview I'd agreed to give, but Cordelia didn't seem to remember this part of our conversation. She had continued to besiege me with requests to speak at literary festivals, appear as a guest on 65 Walrus Street, and even attend one of President Formby's informal song and ukulele evenings. Job offers arrived daily. Numerous libraries and private security firms asked for my services as either active associate or security consultant. The sweetest letter I got was from the local library, asking me to come in and read to the elderly, something I delighted in doing. But Spec Ops itself, the body to which I had committed much of my adult life, energy and resources, hadn't even spoken to me about advancement. As far as they were concerned, I was SO27 and would remain so until they decided otherwise. "Mail for you," announced Landon, dumping a large pile of post onto the kitchen table. Most of my mail these days was fan mail, and pretty strange it was too. I opened an envelope at random. "Anyone I should be jealous of?" he asked. "I should keep the divorce lawyer on hold for a few more minutes. It's another request for underwear." "I'll send him a pair of mine," grinned Landon. "What's in the parcel?" "Late wedding present. It's a..." He looked at the strange knitted object curiously. "It's a... thing." "Good," I replied. "I always wanted one of those. What are you doing?" "I'm trying to teach Pickwick to stand on one leg." "Dodos don't do tricks," I told him. "For a marshmallow, I think I can make him do anything." "Up, Pickwick. Come on, one leg up." Landon was a writer. We first met when he, my brother Anton, and I fought in the Crimea. Landon came home minus a leg, but alive. My brother was still out there, making his way through eternity from the comfort of a military cemetery near Sevastopol. I opened another letter and read aloud. "Dear Miss Next, I'm one of your biggest fans. I thought you should know that I believe David Copperfield, far from being the doe-eyed innocent, actually murdered his first wife, Dora Spenlow, in order to marry Agnes Wickfield. I suggest an exhumation of Miss Spenlow's remains and a test for podulism and or arsenic. While we are on the subject, have you ever stopped to wonder why Homer changed his mind about dogs somewhere between the Iliad and the Odyssey? Was he perhaps given a puppy between the two? Another thing, do you find Joyce's Ulysses as boring and as unintelligible as I do? And why don't Hemingway's works have any smells in them?" "Seems everyone wants you to investigate their favourite book," observed Landon, sliding his arms around my neck and looking over my shoulder so closely our cheeks touched and I shivered. He put his mouth close to my ear and whispered, "While you're about it, can you try and get Tess acquitted and Max de Winter convicted?" "Not you as well." I took the marshmallow from his hand and ate it, much to Pickwick's shock and dismay. Landon took another marshmallow from the jar and tried again. "Up, Pickwick. Come on, up, up, one leg." Pickwick stared at Landon blankly, eyes fixed on the marshmallow and not at all interested in learning tricks. "You'll need a truckload of them, Land." I refolded the letter, finished my coffee, got up and put on my jacket. "Have a good day," said Landon, seeing me to the door. "Be nice to the other children. No scratching or biting. I'll behave myself, I promise." I wrapped my arms around his neck and kissed him. "Mmm," I whispered softly. "That was nice." I've been practicing, he told me, on that pretty young thing at number 56. You don't mind, do you? Not at all, I replied, kissing him again, so long as you want to keep your other leg. Okay, I think I'll stick to you for practice from now on. I'm depending on it. Oh, and Land? Yeah? Don't forget it's Mycroft's retirement party this evening. I won't. We bade each other goodbye, and I walked down the garden path, shouting a greeting to Mrs. Arturo, who had been watching us. It was late autumn, or early winter, I wasn't sure which. It had been mild and windless. The leaves were still brown on the trees, and on some days it was hardly cold at all. It had to really get chilly to put the top up on my speedster, so I drove into the Spec Ops Divisional HQ with the wind in my hair and Wessex FM blaring on the wireless. The upcoming election was the talk of the airwaves. The controversial cheese duty had suddenly become an issue in the way things do just before an election. There was a snippet about Goliath declaring themselves to be the world's favourite conglomerate for the 10th year running, whilst in the Crimean peace talks, Russia had demanded Kent County as war reparations. In sport, Aubrey Jam had led the Swindon Mallets croquet team into Superhoop 85 by thrashing the Reading Whackers. I drove through the morning traffic in Swindon and parked the speedster at the rear of the Spec Ops HQ. The building was of a brusque, no-nonsense Germanic design, hastily erected during the occupation. The facade still bore battle scars from Swindon's liberation in 1949. It housed most of the Spec Ops divisions, but not all. Our vampire and werewolf disposal operation also encompassed Reading and Salisbury, and in return Salisbury's art theft division looked after our area as well. It all seemed to work quite well. Hello, I said to a young man who was taking a cardboard box out of the boot of his car. New Spec Ops? Yes, he replied, putting down his box for a moment to offer me his hand. John Smith. Weeds and Seeds. Unusual name, I said, shaking his hand. I'm Thursday next. Oh, he said, looking at me with interest. Sadly, my anonymity had, it seemed, departed for good. Yes, I replied, picking up several large box files for him. That Thursday next. Weeds and Seeds? Domestic Horticulture Enforcement Agency, explained John as we walked towards the Spec Ops building. SO32. I'm starting an office here. There's been a rise in the number of hackers just recently. The Pampas Grass Vigilante Squad are becoming more brazen in their activities. Pampas Grass might well be an eyesore, but there's nothing illegal in it. We showed our ID cards to the desk sergeant and walked up the stairs to the second floor. I heard something about that, I murmured. Any links to the Anti-Lay Lendi Association? Nothing positive, replied Smith, but I'm following all leads. How many in your squad? Including me?
One,
grinned Smith. Thought you were the most underfunded department in Spec Ops. Think again. I've got 6 months to sort out the hackers, get the Japanese knotweed under control, and find an acceptable plural of Narcissus. We reached the upstairs corridor and a small office that had once been home to SO31, the Good Taste Education Authority. The division had been disbanded a month ago when the proposed legislation against stone cladding, pictures of crying clowns, and floral patterned carpets failed in the upper house. I placed the box files on the table, told him Narcissi was my favourite, wished him well and left him to unpack. I was just walking past the office of SO14 when I heard a shrill voice. Thursday! Thursday! Yoo-hoo! Over here! I sighed. It was Cordelia Flack. She quickly caught up with me and gave me an affectionate hug. The lush show was a disaster, I told her. You said it was no holds barred. I ended up talking about dodos, my car, and anything but Jane Eyre. You were terrific, she enthused. I've got you lined up for another set of interviews the day after tomorrow. No more, Cordelia. She looked crestfallen. I don't understand. What part of no more don't you understand? Don't be like that, Thursday, she replied, smiling broadly. You're good PR, and believe me, in an institution that routinely leaves the public perforated, confused, old before their time, or, if they're lucky, dead. We need every bit of good PR we can muster. Do we do that much damage to the public? I asked. Flack smiled modestly. Perhaps my PR is not so bad after all, she conceded, then added quickly. But every Joe that gets trounced in a crossfire is one too many. That's as may be, I retorted. But the fact remains you told me the Lush Show would be the last. Ah, but I also told you the Lush Show would be no holds barred, didn't I? observed Cordelia brightly, displaying staggering reverse logic. However you want to spin it, Cordelia, the answer is still no. As I watched with a certain detached amusement, Flack went through a bizarre routine that included hopping up and down for a bit, pulling pleading expressions, wringing her hands, puffing out her cheeks and staring at the ceiling. Okay, I sighed. You've got my attention. What do you want me to do? Well, said Cordelia excitedly, we ran a competition. Oh, yes? I asked suspiciously, wondering whether it could be any more daft than her win a mammoth idea the week before. What sort of competition? Well, we thought it would be a good idea if you met a few members of the public on a one-to-one basis. Did we? Now listen, Cordelia. Dilly Thursday, since we're pals. She sensed my reticence and added, Cords then, Ordelia, how about Flacky? I used to be called Flick Flack at school. Can I call you Thurs? Cordelia, I said in a harsher tone, before she ingratiated herself to death. I'm not going to do this. You said the Lush interview would be the last, and it is. I started to walk away, but when God was handing out insistence, Cordelia Flack was right at the front of the queue. Thursday, this hurts me really personally when you're like this. It attacks me right here. She made a wild guess at where her heart might be and looked at me with a pained expression that she probably learnt off a Springer Spaniel. I've got them waiting right here, now, in the canteen. It won't take a moment. 10 minutes, tops. Please, 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 please. I've only asked 2 dozen journalists and news crews. The room will be practically empty. I looked at my watch. 10 minutes. Whoa! Who's that? Thursday next. Who's what? Someone calling my name. Didn't you hear it? No, replied Cordelia, looking at me oddly. I tapped my ears and looked around to see if there was anyone close by. Apart from Cordelia, we were alone in the corridor. It had sounded so real it was disconcerting. Miss Next. Hello? Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3. There it goes again. There goes what again? A man's voice speaking here, inside my head. I pointed to my temple to demonstrate. Cordelia took a step backwards, her look turning to one of consternation. Are you okay, Thursday? Can I call someone? Oh, no, no, I'm fine. I just realized that I left a receiver in my ear. It must be my partner. There's a 12:14 or a 10:30 or something numerological in progress. Tell your competition winners another time. Goodbye. I dashed off down the corridor toward the literary detective's offices. There wasn't a receiver, of course, but I wasn't having Flack tell the quacks I was hearing voices. If you're busy, Miss Next, we can talk later. I stopped and looked around. The corridor was empty. I can hear you, I said, but where are you? The name is Snell, Acrid Snell. Who was that disturbingly attractive woman in the tight pink... Her name's Flack. Works over at Spec Ops PR. Really? Is she married? What is this? Spec Ops blind date? What's going on? Sorry. Should have said. I'm the defense attorney assigned to your case. Case? What case? I haven't done anything. Of course not. That's our defense strategy in a nutshell. You are completely innocent. If we can convince the examining magistrate, we can probably get a postponement. My indignation was real. For someone who had spent her life enforcing law and order, it seemed a grave injustice that I should be accused of something, especially something I knew nothing about. For God's sake, Snell, what is the charge?
Are you okay, Next?
It was Commander Braxton Hicks. He had just turned the corner and was staring at me with curiosity. Nothing, sir. I said, thinking fast. The Spec Ops tensionologist said I should vocalize any stress regarding past experiences. Listen, get away from me, Hades, go. See, I feel better already.
Oh, said Hicks doubtfully. Well, the quacks know best, I suppose. That Lush fellow's interview was a cracker, don't you think?
Thankfully, he didn't give me time to answer and carried on talking.
Listen here, Next. Did you sign that picture for my godson, Max?
On your desk, sir.
Really? Jolly good. What else? Oh, yes. That PR girlie.
Miss Flack?
That's the chap. She ran a competition or something. Would you liaise with her over it?
I'll make it my top priority, sir.
Good. Well, carry on vocalizing then.
Thank you, sir. But he didn't leave. He just stood there, watching me. Sir?
Don't mind me, replied Hicks. I just want to see how this stress vocalizing works. My tensionologist told me to arrange pebbles as a hobby, or count blue cars.
So I vocalized my stress there in the corridor for 5 minutes, reciting every Shakespearean insult I could think of while my boss watched me. I felt a complete twit, but rather that than the quacks, I suppose.
Jolly good,
he said finally and walked off. After checking I was alone in the corridor, I spoke out loud.
Snell!
Silence.
Mr. Snell, can you hear me?
More silence. I sat down on a convenient bench and put my head between my knees. I felt sick and hot. Both the Spec Ops resident tensionologist and stresspert had said I might have some sort of traumatic aftershock from tackling Asher on Hades, but I hadn't expected anything so vivid as voices in my head. I waited until my head cleared and then made my way not towards Flack and her competition winners, but towards Bowden and the Literatech's office.
Miss Next, I'm so sorry. I had to take a call. Portia again. She wanted to discuss the timing of her drop of blood defense. Bit of a feisty one, that. Your hearing is next Thursday, so be prepared.
I stopped. Prepared for what? I haven't done anything.
That's good, Thursday. Can I call you Thursday?
Keep up that sort of wide-eyed, innocent babe-in-the-wood stuff, and we'll have you off the hook quicker than you can save a Ruka.
No, no! I exclaimed. I really don't know what I've done.
Where are you?
I'll explain it all when we meet. Sorry to have to communicate with you in footnotes, but I'm due in court in 10 minutes. Don't speak to anyone at all about the case, and I'll see you on Thursday.
Thursday? That's quite funny, that. Thursday, Thursday.
Maybe not.
Got to go. Remember, speak to no one about the case. And if you have a moment, see if you can find out anything about that flat girl's domestic arrangements.
Well, chin chin and toodle pip.
Wait! Shouldn't I see you before the hearing? There was no answer. I was about to yell again, but several people came out of the elevator, so I kept quiet. I waited for a moment, but Mr. Snell didn't seem to have anything more to add, so I made my way into the Literatech office, which closely resembled a large library in a country home somewhere. There weren't many books we didn't have, the result of bootleg seizures of literary works collected over the years. My partner, Bowden Cable, was already at his desk, which was as fastidiously neat as ever. He was dressed conservatively and was a few years younger than me, although he had been in Spec Ops a lot longer. Officially, he was a higher rank, but we never let it get in the way. We worked as equals, but in different ways. Bowden's quiet and studious approach contrasted strongly with my own directness. It seemed to work well.
Morning, Bowden.
Hello, Thursday. Saw you on telly last night.
I took off my coat, sat down, and started to rummage through telephone messages.
How did I look?
Fine. They didn't let you talk about Jane Eyre much, did they?
Press freedom was on holiday that day.
He understood and smiled softly.
Never fear. Someday the full story will be told.
Are you okay? You look a little flushed.
I'm okay, I told him, giving up on the telephone messages. Actually, I'm not. I've been hearing voices.
Stress, Thursday.
It's not unusual.
Anyone specific?
I got up to fetch some coffee, and Bowden followed me. A lawyer named Acrid Snell said he was representing me. Refill?
No, thanks.
On what charge?
He wouldn't say.
I poured myself a large coffee as Bowden thought for a moment.
Sounds like an inner guilt conflict, Thursday.
In policing, we have to sometimes...
He stopped as two other Literatech agents walked close by, discussing the merits of a recently discovered 78-word palindrome that made sense. We waited until they were out of earshot before continuing.
We have to sometimes close off our emotions.
Could you have killed Hades if you were thinking clearly?
I don't think I would have been able to kill him if I wasn't, I replied, sniffing at the milk. I've not lost a single night's sleep over Hades, but poor Bertha Rochester bothers me a bit. We went and sat down at our desks.
Maybe that's it, replied Bowden,
idly filling in the owl crossword.
Perhaps you secretly want to be held accountable for her death. I heard Cromarty talking to me for weeks after his murder. I thought I should have been there to back him up, but I wasn't.
How are you getting along with the crossword? He passed it over and I scanned the answers.
What's a rilk? I asked him.
It's a... Ah, there you are, said a booming voice.
We turned to see Victor Analogy striding across from his office. Head of the Swindon Literatech since who knows when, he was a sprightly 70-something with a receding hairline and a figure that guaranteed the part of Santa Claus at the Spec Ops Christmas party. Despite his jocular nature, he could be as hard as nails on occasion and was a good buffer between SO27 and Braxton Hicks, who was strictly a company man. Analogy guarded our independence closely and regarded all his staff as family, and we thought the world of him. We all said our good mornings and Victor sat on my desk.
How's the PR stuff going, Thursday?
More tedious than Spencer, sir.
That bad, eh? Saw you on the telly last night. Rigged, was it?
Just a little.
I hate to be a bore, but it's all important stuff. Have a look at this fax.
He handed me a sheet of paper, and Bowden read over my shoulder. Ludicrous, I said, handing the fax back. What possible benefit could the Toast Marketing Board get from sponsoring us? Victor shrugged.
Not a clue. But if they have cash to give away, we could certainly do with some of it.
What are you going to do?
Braxton's speaking to them this afternoon. He's very big on the idea.
I bet he is. Braxton Hicks's life revolved around his precious Spec Ops budget. If any of us even thought of doing any sort of overtime, you could bet that Braxton would have something to say about it. And something in his case meant no. Rumour had it that he had spoken to the canteen about giving out smaller helpings for dinner. He had been known as Small Portions in the office ever since, but never to his face.
"Did you find out who's been forging and trying to sell the missing ending to Byron's Don Juan?" asked Victor.
Bowden showed him a black-and-white photo of a dashing figure climbing into a parked car somewhere near the airship field. He was extravagantly dressed according to the Byron look. It was quite popular, even amongst non-Byrons. "Our prime suspect is a fellow named Byron, too." Victor looked at the picture carefully, first through his spectacles, then over the top of them.
Byron number two, eh? How many Byrons are there now?
Byron 2620 was registered last week, I told him. We've been following Byron two for a month, but he's smart. None of the forged scraps of heaven and earth can be traced back to him.
Wiretap?
We tried, but the judge said that even though Byron II's surgery to make his foot clubbed in an attempt to emulate his hero was undeniably strange, and then getting his half-sister pregnant was plainly disgusting, those acts only showed a fevered Byronic mind, and not necessarily one of intent to forge. We have to catch him inky-fingered, but at the moment he's off on a tour of the Mediterranean. We're going to attempt to get a search warrant while he's away.
So you're not that busy, then?
What had you in mind?
Well, began Victor, it seems there have been a couple more attempts to forge Cardenio. I know it's small beer for you two, but it helps Braxton with his damnable statistics. Would you go and have a look?
Sure, replied Bowden, knowing full well I would concur.
Got the addresses?
He handed over a sheet of paper and bade us luck. We rose to leave, Bowden studying the list carefully.
We'll go to Rosebery Street first, he muttered. It's closer.